You're always in danger that politicians will sell fake sound bites and destroy the economy and get elected.
Next fall's statewide election may already be hampering the chances for a budget deal. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage Police Department takes over patrols on part of the Seward Highway.
It's going to be something that we do when they have the staffing available to do that and not impact service inside the city.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The next statewide election is more than a year away, but electoral politics may already be affecting the chances for lawmakers to agree on a lasting solution to the state's dire financial situation. Candidates have been announcing plans for governor, lieutenant governor, and the legislature since July, and they're taking positions that could make a budget deal more difficult. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Almost two-thirds of legislators have already indicated they'll run in next year's election. Anchorage Republican Senator Kevin Meyer is one of three lawmakers who filed for statewide office. He wants to be lieutenant governor. Meyer says Governor Bill Walker's call for a special session on October 23rd has led candidates to file early.
I'm going to blame the governor on that, because when we're in session, whether it's special session or regular session, we can't raise money. We are forced to get an earlier start, like now, to make our announcement, do our paperwork, and start doing the fundraising. We are in the campaign mode, whether you're running for your House seat or Senate seat or statewide office. That will have an impact on the success of this special session.
Walker has called for the legislature to consider a 1.5% tax on wages and self-employment income. It would raise $320 million. Roughly $1 and $8 needed to close a $2.5 billion gap between what the state spends each year and what it raises in revenue. Walker spokeswoman Grace Jang says the special session was needed. The independent governor also has put a bill related to criminal sentencing on the session agenda.
Governor Walker called the special session to fix the economy and address public safety, because neither of those things can wait.
Meyer says Walker's tax proposal is similar to an income tax the Senate has already voted against. He notes the Senate Majority Caucus is asking Walker to make more cuts to spending before asking for new revenue. It's been nearly 2 years since Walker proposed a plan to balance the budget. If lawmakers can't reach a compromise before the election, it could take at least another year and a half to settle on a plan. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says a delay will hurt the economy.
I'm always hopeful for compromise in politics. Right now, with a growing recession, losing 14,000 jobs in the last 2 years, you're always in danger that politicians will sell fake sound bites and destroy the economy and get elected.
Garris says the Senate majority plan to cut the size of government further will lower employment.
You're killing jobs by soundbiting your way into a bigger recession.
It's not just sitting lawmakers who are dissecting potential plans to balance the budget. Republican candidate for Governor Scott Hawkins says he supports part of a plan to draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for government, but he opposes the size of the cut the legislature made to permanent fund dividends.
I supported certain elements of it. The fatal mistake it made was arbitrarily setting the value of the dividend and setting it at a lower level than it really needs to be.
The lack of agreement on a long-term plan disturbs Gunnar Knapp, a retired professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
It's frustrating to see us go year after year after year and not be able to come to a resolution about our fiscal situation, and now to hear that, well, we got an election coming up, and so expect another year to go by without anything real happening.
Knapp says the uncertainty is hurting the economy.
Who's going to move to Alaska to take a job here and start a new career if they don't know what kind of public services we're going to have, what kind of taxes there are going to be, what kind of future we are looking at?
The October special session will be the ninth of Walker's 3 years in office. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Funded with a new state grant, the Anchorage Police Department says its officers will take over patrolling the Seward Highway along Turnagain Arm on October 1st. The move comes after state budget cuts forced the Alaska State Troopers to close their Girdwood post in the area and scale back in the last year. Featuring rocks on one side and water on the other, the patrol zone from McHugh Creek to Ingram Creek is a scenic stretch of highway, but one of the most heavily trafficked and dangerous in Alaska.
Clearly, that stretch of highway should have some law enforcement presence.
That's Anchorage Police Chief Justin Dahl. Dahl, a former traffic sergeant, says the police department has added officers recently so that he now feels comfortable the highway patrols will not take away from officers' ability to respond to calls in the city, which has seen an uptick in crime recently. Dahl says officers will respond to specific calls in communities along the highway under an agreement with a newly created police service area. But he says APD patrol cars will not be looking for traffic violations on the highway around the clock.
You know, it's not going to be an every second of every day type patrol. It's going to be something that we do when they have the staffing available to do that and not impact service inside the city.
While state budget cuts have left the gap for the APD to fill, it is a state grant paying for the patrols. The $200,000 injection is only set to last 1 year. After that, the question of who provides traffic enforcement in the area will again be uncertain. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation denied a climate change petition today submitted by a group of teens. The petition asked the state to reduce carbon emissions, monitor greenhouse gases, and come up with a long-term climate change strategy. In late August, the teens hand-delivered the petition to DEC Commissioner Larry Hardig. In his rejection letter, Hardig said the request posed significant consequences for employment and resource development in the state. Seb Kurland, a member of Alaska Youth for Environmental Action, the group that submitted the proposal, was initially disappointed by the decision, but the 17-year-old from Juneau isn't giving up.
I'm hopeful that the governor and the lieutenant governor will take action on this subject and their newly appointed members will do something about it.
The governor's office has made some strides to address climate change since the teens voiced their concern. The administration created a new position and appointed a climate change advisor. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott says a climate plan is forthcoming. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare appearance of Japanese naval musicians at an Anchorage school.
All of us need to be bridge builders, and especially someone who speaks two languages or is, you know, bicultural.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Today, there was a first-of-a-kind concert in Anchorage. Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Force, basically the country's Navy, is in Anchorage for 4 days as part of a training mission. Two ships are anchored in the city's port. The crew has been at sea since April, visiting different countries to promote goodwill. And as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, part of that mission today involved a very prestigious concert inside a school gym.
Hundreds of students at Central Middle School fill up the bleachers. They're here for a concert, but several of them look perplexed. In front of the band's normal chairs, microphones, and music stands are several stout wooden drums. Taiko drums. The sound fills the gym, making every surface vibrate. Drummers slam sticks thicker than broom handles in perfect coordination, circling their arms overhead and lunging their fists forward every few measures. It's like martial arts set to a beat.
It's energetic and almost like a artistic sport in a way.
Erica Ninoyu is the director of bands at Central Middle School. She's also second-generation Japanese and president of the Japan-Alaska Association, which put her in a perfect position when she heard that for the first time in 7 years, the Japanese Navy would be stopping in Anchorage.
I just asked, you know, well, would they be interested in performing for my school? And they said yes.
Part of the reason Nonoyu is so excited is that the musicians in the Maritime Self-Defense Force are the best of the best. The visiting crew has been traveling all across the Pacific, partly to get 200 newly commissioned officers better acquainted with seamanship, but also as cultural ambassadors. These musicians are the A-team, and Nonoyu is thrilled that they're here, flanked by basketball hoops, performing for her students.
It's rare. I don't know when they're ever going to hear a professional performance of this caliber.
And the students seem to dig it too. After the first song, they erupt with applause so loud it almost rivals the drums. The band is much bigger than the Taiko drummers. There's a brass section, woodwinds, a keyboard, electric bass, and even a jazzy saxophone. Nonoyu says the hour-long concert is the first time the Japanese Navy has ever played inside an Anchorage school, and she thinks that's significant.
I do a lot of work outside the school and also promote it to my students that all of us need to be bridge builders, and especially someone who speaks two languages or is, you know, bicultural in a sense. I think it's our duty to, you know, share and empathize and learn from each other.
None of the members of the squadron visiting Central Middle School were cleared to talk on record with members of the media. Their time in Alaska included a short stop at Homer earlier this week, and they're set to attend a ceremony at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. After departing Alaska, the sailors' next stop is Vladivostok, Russia. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A new documentary film looks at how climate change is affecting Arctic ecosystems. Between Earth and Sky, Climate Change on the Last Frontier was created by scientists. Executive producer David Weindorf is a dean at Texas Tech. He says bringing students to the edge of Anwar to examine Arctic soils was life-changing for them because the remote Arctic places were no longer an abstract place on a map.
And so they really got to see how things like the pipeline and mining exploration and things like that are impacting the land surface up there in Alaska. So I started bringing students up every year.
Weindorf says Arctic soils are rich and deep with organic material, something that isn't seen in Texas. The students studied the differences between the stunted growth of black spruce on the northern side of the slope, where permafrost is prevalent.
Whereas on the south-facing slopes, you typically don't have permafrost. There's more solar radiation there, keeps things warmer. So seeing that kind of dichotomy, literally if you go around the slope, you know, one side of the slope to the other, you can see tremendous differences in the soil profiles in Alaska. Well, it was just dramatic to see that.
Weindorf says the scientific changes he's observed in the Arctic over the last decade are striking, and the interviews he's conducted with Alaska Natives and other Alaskans back up what the science reveals.
We felt like that was a really important piece of the film, to go to Kotzebue and Shishmaref and Nome and those areas that are really on the front lines of these changes, and hear from those people and how that science is impacting them and their everyday lives.
Weindorf says he wants the film to be educational for people in the lower 48, saying the film has no other agenda than scientists documenting the truth about a changing climate.
To let them know, hey, you know, you've never been to Alaska, you've never been to the Tulik Research Station, you know, up on the North Slope, you haven't seen the kind of things that we've seen, but we can tell you things are really accelerating as far as changes that are going on up there. These aren't just abstract things, you know, that we might hear about in the news. This is impacting people's lives.
Between Earth and Sky, Climate Change on the Last Frontier will show tomorrow at the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage and Saturday in Palmer. You can find more information on our website, alaskapublic.org. Two things that Petersburg has a lot of are fish and wood. And one thing the local local rocky terrain is short on is dirt. But given the right circumstances, you can get dirt out of fish and wood. KFSK's Angela Denning reports on a new business venture by the local tribe to provide the town with locally made, environmentally friendly compost.
Walking on the road into the landfill, you pass by piles of automobiles, rubber tires, and eventually come to three large, white, portable buildings. This is where the local tribe makes compost. In one of the tents is a large stainless steel machine, that's cylinder in shape, sitting on top of a trailer. The tribe paid $15,000 for it and had it shipped in this fall from Manitoba, Canada.
We have a load in it right now, and it's been cooking since last Friday.
This is Brandon Tines, the tribal resource director.
You just kind of layer it like lasagna with wood chips and fish waste and wood chips to cover it so it doesn't smell.
Tines and his assistant, Clifton Gudgel, open up the lid. And he's right. It doesn't smell. It just looks like dark brown wood chips.
The temperature should get up to 160, 140. It's pretty crazy to open up your pile and all of a sudden steam is just rolling out of it. It's pretty amazing.
Before working for the tribe, PIA, Tines used to be a commercial fisherman. He knew there was a lot of fish waste. It gets ground up and dumped into the water in front of town by local processing plants. Now Tines gets some of that leftover fish for free. The tribe uses up to 500 pounds a week for compost.
It's a great year-round business for the tribe to do, is helping the environment by not pumping that fish waste into our narrows.
If there's a shortage of fish, Tina says they can always use kelp. The wood they get from scraps around town that would otherwise get burned at the landfill. It's usually alder because it grows fast and people often want to cut it back. PIA puts it through a wood chipper and it's ready for compost. But they won't just use any scraps. They have to know where it's from and that it hasn't come in contact with pesticides or other chemicals.
It's not labeled organic, but it is organic because we don't add anything to it.
The composting machine is on a timer, so it rotates every 2 hours. It takes about 2 weeks for the fish and wood to become dirt, and then it needs to sit and cure for a month before it can be used. After a batch is done, they'll filter out any leftover pieces of wood to go into the next batch.
It's actually like a little starter, kind of like sourdough, where the microbes are on these pieces already, so it spreads throughout the compost a lot faster.
PIA has been making compost for years. In the past, the tribe used an older model composting machine that kept breaking down. Then workers made compost by hand, by what's called static aerated piles. Wood chips and fish were layered in a heap on the ground, which would get aerated and turned occasionally. But the process was lengthy, and when Tina started working for the tribe a year and a half ago, he wanted to expand. He says they were missing opportunities.
Like Juno wanted quite a bunch, like 50 cubic yards, and we just couldn't make enough to get what they wanted. So, but it was stuff like that, like, you know, opportunities, you know, to make it a business and hire some more tribe members so that they could have a full year-round job that pays well.
Gudgel, Tines's assistant, says he likes having a job where he can work outside.
Getting out there and getting the materials and throwing it all together and just doing something different rather than standing behind a desk or stocking things on shelves.
Tines keeps a detailed notebook of batch results, what goes in when and at what temperature. On average, this machine can produce about 40 pounds of compost a day. PIA plans to sell it in 40-pound bags within a few months. It will cost about the same price as imported compost sells for at the store, but Tines says this stuff will be pure local product.
You know, the big companies that do it, they don't care what they throw in there. They just, you know, like, throw it in, it's a nitrogen, throw it in, it's a carbon, you know, and then people are just getting a mixed bag of who knows what's in it. But with us, you'll know what's in it.
And when it's done?
It just pretty much looks like dirt.
Kind of like fluffy, mulchy dirt.
PIA's composting project is funded by IGAP, the Indian Environmental General Assistance Program. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
In October, the State Department of Education will honor the important work of teachers by selecting the next Teacher of the Year from 4 finalists. We've been bringing those teachers to the air this week. Today, we'll hear from the final candidate, Eric Rush. He teaches 3rd grade at Tickasuck Brown Elementary in North Pole and has been a teacher for 9 years. He says he's had many inspiring teachers in his life, but credits his wife, who is also a teacher, with encouraging him to become a teacher. Rush says even in 3rd grade, technology can be a challenging distraction, but also a terrific tool for creating interest and excitement for learning.
If I have kids that are reluctant readers that don't want to read a book, I'll say, hey, have you ever seen an interactive book? And they'll kind of engaged in that. They want to know what's an interactive book. Then I can show them an interactive library on an iPad. I mean, it's still reading, but it's reading in a different way. And that kind of really gets them excited about reading.
How do you think classrooms today, the students that you're teaching in your classroom, okay, is different, both challenges and benefits, than when you were a student, when you were a kid in school?
The teacher was my main information, you know. If I wanted to know something new, the teacher was the main focus, you know. If I didn't listen to the teacher, I was missing out on a lot of information. Now, the information's all out there. Information's at our fingertips. Well, now, we're no longer the focus of the information. We need to guide those children, the students, to find the information, find what's fact, what's fiction, you know, all those things. And I feel like we shouldn't, teachers now shouldn't think that they're the main speaker. The speaker should be the students. That's how they're learning, you know. It's a shift. The teacher's no longer the main source of information. It's kids learning how to use the information that's already out there.
One of the things you said was, I don't teach to a class, I teach to the individual. What did you mean by that?
So when I think of, you know, old teaching styles or methods, I think the teacher up in the front of the blackboard or whiteboard and the crowd of students sitting and waiting for whatever the teacher's saying, and the teacher's teaching to the class. Well, some student might be putting his head down, might be paying attention to something else, but the teacher's still going on with the lecture or the presentation or the lesson. I said that I teach to the individual. I make sure that I make contact with those students, each student, checking in with them and making sure that they're understanding the content that I just showed.
When you think about the future of education and teaching, what do you think it will look like?
It's hard to say what it will be. What I hope it won't be is where teachers are not in the classroom. What I would love to see is every school's incorporating devices, but also having enough professional development and trainings in those areas of, you know, certain devices or programs that will work for the child so that the child can progress at their own pace. Because not every kid is going to be 3rd grade ready at the beginning of the year for me. And I know that. And I want to make sure that I have things available for that child to not feel like they're going to keep being behind. I want them to feel like they're getting success.
Eric Rush is one of 4 finalists to be the next Alaska Teacher of the Year. A winner will be named next month. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. The first cohort of Alaska Salmon Fellows is wrapping up its pilot year with final projects. The program brings together innovators in the state, from policymakers to artists, and prompts them to start discussions about the salmon industry. The Baranoff Museum and its partners invited the public to see a slideshow of artists whose work reflects the relationship between Alaskans and salmon. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche attended.
people gather on the museum grounds, a projector plays a slideshow on a screen outside. It's perfect weather for an event like this, not raining hard, but just overcast enough to keep people in town instead of out camping or hiking. A Salmon Fellows organizer has made it in for the occasion. Kitty Farnham is the director of leadership programs at the Alaska Humanities Forum. She wears an Alaska Salmon Fellows jacket, which features an icon of colorful fish. At the beginning of the event, she explains all 16 Salmon Fellows are doing projects in their particular areas, like education, history, or policy.
Being the Humanities Forum, we're really looking at it through the people lens. And all the data in the world is valuable, but without having the relationships between people in different sectors, there's really no way to address solutions that don't become embroiled in win-lose, and we're looking for solutions that really work across our communities.
People wander in. Some stop in the yard to chat, and a couple play a game called Cornhole, aiming beanbags at a hole in a board. The sacks thump against the wood. This is the kind of gathering Salmon Projections aims for. Farnham says the project is meant to spark conversation.
There's some parallel projects around looking at management systems, relationships between organizations and the official regulating bodies, education, really also trying to change the narrative from one of we can't agree on, you know, a sense of zero-sum game and allocations to what's best for our communities and for salmon.
On the porch, attendees snack on sushi. Just inside the building, seaweed salad and smoked salmon are available alongside tea bags and a samovar full of hot water. By the end of the night, the platter of salmon is empty. That's one thing most people who attend have in common. No matter what their relationship to the fishing industry, they usually eat fish, and they tend to agree that the larger aim is to keep the fisheries healthy and strong. Sports fisherman Brent Priestess says the state should focus on industry sustainability.
I think we keep doing what we've been doing as long as we value it and place a proper emphasis on the salmon over other kinds of development. I think it will continue.
Ginny Osterman, a longtime Kodiak resident, says the local fishing industry needs community growth.
Things like cold storage and more processing plants and jobs for local people are very important, as well as making sure that there's fish for next year.
Rita Stevens agrees it's important to build up local infrastructure.
Like improve the dock situation for the boats and the storage of boats in the dry dock, and having repair shops here instead of having to go down to Seattle, take the business away from Kodiak.
The museum encourages more conversations like these by setting up pieces of paper covered with questions about fisheries and sustainability and asking people to scribble their responses. The Salmon Fellows will convene again in a couple of weeks. Farnham says they're recruiting now for the next round of fellows, and the application period opens at the beginning of the year. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.